The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I have about three or four litres of content and one litre of time, so let me get to it. My favourite piece of graffiti that I've ever seen was on a toilet wall in Byron Bay. It said, "Nostalgia ain't what it used to be." A clever mind. Now, when it comes to talking about Christendom, very much I think we're talking about nostalgia, or we're on the way to it just being nostalgia. And what is Christendom, I hear you ask? Let me go to a definition that's found in the New Dictionary of Theology. Here we go. The term Christendom has come to be particularly applied to that period of Christian history in which the Christian religion was an integral and fundamental part of the social order. Okay. Now, when did that happen? When did Christianity... It's really about Christianity and the state being very good friends. The turning point in Christian history which changed the relationship of the church to the state from one of hostility or grudging acceptance to one of privilege and mutual affirmation was the conversion of Constantine, the Roman emperor, in around 312 AD. The arrival of the Christian emperor in time changed the whole relationship of the church to the state. And you notice what it said, the turning point, it turned from grudging acceptance to what? One of privilege and mutual affirmation. Now, of course, I was taught, or at least I understood at Bible college decades ago, that Constantine, the Roman emperor, had been pretty much the saviour of the Christian church. He brought privilege, mutual affirmation, and the church took on a very powerful role in Western culture. Perhaps in the last few centuries, it might be fair to say that the church has become the official chaplain to the state. Now, I think this has begun to fade away. And what are we told? How and why has it begun to fade away? It's taken the combination of the Enlightenment, secularisation, political revolution and reform, and the development of a pluralistic social order to finally destroy the reality of Christendom. Only memories remain in the aspects of our culture in folk religion. And so this idea of the chaplain to the state, the privileged position of Christianity, it's disappearing. I don't think it's completely gone, but it's disappearing. There are still, you can still see glimpses of it if you look. So, for example, the Anzac Day dawn service, if you haven't been recently, I'd recommend it. It's a good morning out, but it's an anachronism. So there's Martin Place, etc. If you go to the Department of Veteran Affairs website, there are very strict guidelines on how to run an Anzac Day dawn service. And what's a gear crunch these days is what's recommended are Christian hymns and Christian prayers, readings from the Bible, etc. Now, people do fudge it, but it's set in concrete as a Christian thing. Why? Because the Anzac Day dawn services are almost 100 years old. And they're frozen in time. In fact, Anzac Day has really become our holy day as a nation. It's sacred. There's been a huge decline in formal religion in our country. In fact, Roy Williams, the author of Post God Nation, who's spoken here at Legal, he lists a whole series of reasons why. His biggest reason at the end has been the huge increase in wealth in our country. So we're at least, it's three times, in real terms, three times more wealthy than we were in the 1950s. So as wealth increases, people tend to ignore God, walk away from him, etc., or feel no need for religion. There's also markers, that things that you see that show how much things have changed in the last 50, 60 years. In our city, Arthur Stace, Mr. Eternity, you may remember the story, from 1960, Arthur Stace died in 1967, buried in Botany Cemetery. Over a period of 35 years, Arthur Stace, who was functionally illiterate, wrote the word eternity in beautiful copperplate letters in chalk. He got up about 5 a.m. and went and did it every day. He wrote it, they estimate, around 500,000 times. So much so that eternity was on the Harbour Bridge back in 2000, if you remember the millennial celebrations. Now, how have things changed? in Bondi, where I run with a few other old guys who shuffle along, and a couple of younger ones, on a Saturday morning, there's a piece of graffiti that is very enlightening, or very insightful. You see the difference? Eternity has become equality. And when you put these two side by side, at first, what's the difference? There's a very, very big difference. There's a marker in how our wider culture has changed. In the public domain, personally, I think that for those opinion makers, for those referred to sometimes as the elites, Christianity has gone from harmlessly irrelevant, something that your grandmother may do, to very often regarded as evil. Christians are the haters now. Why? Well, because love wins, as well as science wins, or pluralism wins, or etc. Ironically, I think you can make a very good case that the very positive things about Western culture, the things that we value so much, the reason so many people want to come into the Western culture, have been created by Christianity. The value and freedom of the individual, the welfare system, the rise of science, modern medicine, the fact that lawmakers are under the law themselves, democracy, the creation of wealth, those things. But now what is happening is the previously privileged position of the Christian church is being pushed to the side or is fading away. And here's what I want to say this morning, and that is, at the end of the talk, I want to suggest to you a reason why this is happening and why I think God is dismantling Christendom. I actually think that God himself is doing that for a reason. Let me come back to it. Now, the question I'd like to address for a few moments then is, for the Christian believer, and I know we're not all necessarily signed up Christians, and some of us are thinking or curious, if you're a signed up Christian believer, if you're a follower of Jesus, how do you live in a culture that is deliberately moving further and further away from mainstream Christian beliefs? How do you live in a culture that really does not acknowledge God and has very different principles? The temptation for Christian people can be like the drunk peasant on the donkey. You know, the drunk peasant falls off one side or falls off the other. The temptation can be to fall off one side, and that would be to withdraw into a kind of a bunker or a silo and have nothing to do with the culture, to disengage completely. The other is to fall off the other side, and that is to kind of blend in and look the same and not be distinctive at all, to kind of give up and roll over, to mix the metaphors. The book of Daniel, in the Old Testament, you have Daniel chapter 1 printed out in your outline. The book of Daniel has a lot to say about how do you live in a culture that's against God, that has very different principles. How do you hold integrity as a believer in God? All I'm going to do today is have a quick look at chapter 1 and I hope motivate you to read especially the first six chapters of the book of Daniel. In 605 BC, the Babylonian juggernaut rolled over Jerusalem. In fact, the Babylonians conquered Jerusalem in a series of stages, 605, 597, 587 BC, over a period of about 15 years. And Jerusalem was destroyed. Basically the cream of the society in Jerusalem were taken back to Babylon. Babylon was a massive empire at the time. And in fact, Babylon's still, it's ruins now, but in modern-day Iraq. Notice, as the book of Daniel's written, so this is dated around 6 centuries BC, Nebuchadnezzar took the city, and yet, see in chapter 1, verse 2, as Daniel writes the story, we find out later in the book that he is writing it, Daniel knows it's not Nebuchadnezzar who took the city necessarily, it's that God, the God of Israel, actually gave him the city. See 1, verse 2. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. It's the Lord, the God of Israel, who's done this. Why? Well, it's his judgment on those people. The corruption in the city, syncretism, the combining of all sorts of different religions, ignoring the prophets that he'd sent, greed, injustice. And God had warned them for centuries that it was going to happen. And finally, bang, it does. Now, in the bigger picture of the Bible, in part of this is God kind of ruling a line under the human kings of Israel and Judah and saying the deliverance, the salvation of people will not come that way. It's almost hitting the reset button. Now, the action moves from Jerusalem to Babylon. And Nebuchadnezzar, in one sense a tyrant, in another way a very clever man, he has a problem. He has a huge empire with all sorts of different ethnic groups, and how do you govern that? The people that he conquered, how do you hold it together? How do you rule it? What he realized was this: take the best and the brightest of all the different groups that you've conquered, the best and the brightest, the young ones, bring them into Babylon and indoctrinate, no, that's a bad word, brainwash, no, that's a, educate, so that's the right word, educate them about the glories and the brilliance of Babylon, win their hearts and minds, and then they will help you govern your empire. Have a look at verse 5. I'm only going to have a quick look at Daniel. The king assigned, that's Nebuchadnezzar, the king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. So he'd chosen the group, shares with them the beautiful wine, meat, food, all that sort of thing from his table. And they were to be trained for 3 years. And after that, they were to enter the king's service. So basically what he's doing is he's training his public service from all these different ethnic groups, etc. They'll be seduced by the power and brilliance of Babylon. And in the story, Daniel and his three friends, his three young friends, and they're probably just teenagers, Hananiah, Mishael and Azariah, are brought into the program, so to speak. They're actually given, in the story, they're actually given Babylonian names. And their previous names had all been about the God of Israel. They're given Babylonian names. They seem to accept that, and those names are used interchangeably during the rest of the story. It's kind of like they get the Rhodes Scholarship on steroids. That's what they're offered. And Babylon was the greatest city in the ancient world. Here's the Ishtar Gates, excavated and now in a museum in Berlin. I think it's actually not theft. If you take something that's not yours, it's not theft as long as you're wearing a pith helmet. I think that's kind of the way it works. Or if you're an archaeologist. The Ishtar Gates, here's an artist's recreation of the procession. You see the Ishtar Gates there. Babylon city of 30, 40 kilometres of walls that were wide enough for chariots to pass on. An artist's recreation, it's in ruins now, but an artist's recreation of what Babylon would have looked like. The Hanging Gardens of Babylon, built by Nebuchadnezzar, apparently for one of his wives who missed her mountain homeland. All sorts of power and prestige, and Daniel and his friends were offered the world on a platter. He said, what you see in Daniel 1, in this culture that didn't recognise his God, Daniel decided, rather than take the world on a platter, Daniel and his friends would, how would you put it, control their appetite. Have a look at verse 8. But Daniel resolved, this is, see, verse 5, the king said, you can have all the food and wine off my table. Verse 8, but Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. And he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in this way. Now, there's been much ink spilled about why he does this, and I've got here listed at least 5 different possibilities from, you know, was it the food laws or idols or... I don't have time to go into it this morning. Happy to answer questions on it later. The best explanation I've heard is this. It was actually a personal thing for him. A personal thing that said, I am not for sale. This is where I draw the line. I serve a different master. I'll cooperate, but you don't own me. And the way he showed that was by not being fed from the king's table. And so he decides to eat only vegetables and drink only water. Which I think to eat only vegetables is a very big commitment. Anyway, that's just me. And so they set out, you read it, in a thoughtful, respectful way to not compromise and to not antagonise people either. And so for the 3 years, they eat vegetables, they drink water, and we're told, see verse 18, at the end of the time set by the king to bring them into service, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael and Azariah, and so they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. So what do you see? The culture's way different. And yet, what do? They cooperate where they can, and they refuse to compromise on what's important. Cooperate, but not compromise. Now, you look at verse 21, Daniel's there until the time of King Cyrus. What it means is, for 65 years, as far as we can work out, 65 years, Daniel was at the very top of the Babylonian hierarchy or public service. Carries huge responsibility and power. By the end of chapter 5 of Daniel, the Babylonian kingdom has become corrupt and weak. You've had a couple of changes of kings. The kings are not, don't have the strength and power that Nebuchadnezzar have. At the end of chapter 5, the Babylonian Empire falls. Cyrus the Persian conquers it. It seems the best way to make sense is that Darius the Mede rules Babylon on behalf of Cyrus for some time. Then in chapter 6, and I just don't have time to go, I hope you read, chapter 1 and chapter 6 are kind of bookends in the story. It's the envy of other powerful men that want to get rid of Daniel. And the issue there is no longer seduction, it's about them actually wanting to destroy him. And so they rule a line. It's interesting that they turn the state, in terms of Darius, they want to turn the state into God and mean that the state has your highest loyalty and that you cannot pray. And that is a line that Daniel will not accept, and so he has to do what he has to do, and hence the story about being thrown to the lions. So what do you see? Chapter 1 and chapter 6, it's interesting. The pressure comes when he's very young and very junior, and the pressure always comes when he's very old and very senior. And yet very relevant to how to live in Australia today if you are a follower of Jesus. The two things, chapter 1's about seduction. All the kingdoms of the world, if you'll just cooperate. Whatever you want. And I think for the followers of Jesus today in Australia, seduction is still the big issue. It's the offer to have whatever you want and what's it called? Lifestyle. You know, success and career and money and house and a holiday house and sport and all of these things. And the great seduction is that you can follow Jesus without cost. Now, I think that's the main issue for followers of Jesus. At the same time, chapter 6 talks about persecution. And I think I can say that as I look down the track, it's not hard to see that persecution will come. If you stand up for Christian principles, you will suffer. It's pretty mild at the moment, but I think the heat is going to be on. The environment is very different to what it was 28 years ago when I finished Bible college. I think England, the United Kingdom, are about 10 years ahead of us in the social changes that are coming. And yet as I look at articles, I see students who've been removed from universities because of Facebook posts that upset the LGBTQI agenda. I've seen a magistrate dismissed because he said something that would have upset people about same-sex marriage. I don't know if you noticed, June 15, Tim Farron resigned as a Liberal Democrat leader in the United Kingdom. Why? Because he said he was not able to do his job as a public figure and be a Christian at the same time. It's coming. I may be paranoid, but just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you, as they say. Now, Jesus says, do not fear their threats, do not be frightened. And what does Jesus say? In your hearts, revere Christ as Lord. This is in 1 Peter, Peter's first letter. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give a reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect. Now, I don't have any trouble with the answer. It's the gentleness and respect part that I have trouble with sometimes. But that's the point, I think. The two issues that Daniel shows us that are very relevant, seduction and persecution. And I think both of them are on the rise, shall we say, in the Australian context. Now, it's worth considering, why is it that Daniel could live in that culture and be unaffected? He'd be effective, polite, engaging, but unaffected. Two things, and I'll be very brief. One is that he understood the sovereignty of God. He understood that everything that happened actually happened under the hand of a God who is in control. Daniel's quite different to other parts of the Bible where the followers of God are persecuted often in Bible books, and yet in Daniel, God intervenes miraculously to rescue. It's almost like God showing that he can do that as he rescues these four young men from, well, old men, rescues these four from the persecution. In the book of Esther, it's different. Esther, God rescues people, and yet God's fingerprints aren't there. God's people are rescued by coincidence in the book of Esther. And yet if you have eyes to see it, it's God behind the coincidences. And then there are other times when God doesn't intervene, as per John the Baptist, for example, who loses his head as Herod has him killed. Daniel understands the sovereignty of God, and it lets him operate without fear. Jesus says, don't fear those who can only kill the body. Fear him who can throw soul and body into hell. He says, the very hairs of your head are numbered. He doesn't say they won't fall out. I don't mean me personally. What I mean is you may still suffer. So an understanding of the sovereignty of God. The second one, I think, is this, that Daniel learned to tread lightly in our world, to not invest everything into our world. And that's what Jesus calls his followers to do. John Lennox, who's actually been out here in 2014 and spoken, a professor of mathematics at Oxford, in his excellent book about the book of Daniel, says this. He says, although he, Daniel, lived in this world, he did not live for it. Although he lived in this world, he did not live for it. It was in another world that he invested his life, and it is there that he now enjoys his inheritance. Daniel believed in eternity and a life beyond this, and that meant he could relate to this world in a different way. So, seduction and persecution. The Apostle Paul writes to the Christians in Philippi. It was a Roman settlement, and they thought their Roman citizenship was so important. Paul says, but our citizenship, writing to the Christians, our citizenship is in heaven, and we eagerly await a Saviour from there, the Lord Jesus Christ. If you have that perspective, that God is in control, to tread lightly in our world, it means you can relate in a different way. Let me finish, though, with... I said I'd come back to the idea of Christendom and why it is that God may be dismantling it. Here's a suggestion. See what you think. 30 years ago at Bible College, I was taught, or at least I understood, that Constantine had been, in some ways, the saviour of the Christian church, that the Roman Emperor had picked up the Christian church and helped them along and strengthened them, etc. My guess is, in 312 AD, when Constantine became emperor and said that he was a Christian, many of the Christian people threw their hats in the air and thought, fantastic. And yet perhaps they threw them in the air too quickly. For the previous 270 or so years, Christianity had been growing very quickly, geometrically, really. Why? Christianity had been a grassroots, viral, sincere, sacrificial movement. To be a Christian leader, pastor, bishop, whatever it was very costly. Costly not just financially, but costly in terms of suffering. It meant that you were motivated, sincere, etc., to lead. So what happened to this viral, grassroots, costly, loving movement? My favourite author, and if you've heard me speak before, you'll know, my favourite author, Rodney Stark, an American academic from Baylor University, says this about Constantine and Christendom. He said, Constantine did not make Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire, nor did he ban paganism. That came later. Constantine's, quote, favour was his decision to divert to the Christians the massive state funding on which the pagan temples had always depended. Overnight, Christianity became, quote, the most favoured recipient of the near limitless resources of imperial favour. A faith that had been meeting in humble structures was suddenly housed in magnificent public buildings. A clergy recruited from the people, modestly sustained by member contributions, suddenly gained immense power, status, and wealth as part of the imperial civil service. Bishops now became grandees on a par with the wealthiest senators in Rome. Consequently, the privileges and exemptions granted the Christian clergy precipitated a stampede into the priesthood. In the wake of Constantine's intrusion into the rise of Christianity, there soon developed two quite distinct churches. These can usefully be identified as the Church of Power and the Church of Piety. The former was the main body of the church as it evolved in response to the immense power and wealth bestowed on the clergy by Constantine. In many ways, the Church of Piety arose as a reaction to the Church of Power being made up of those who were still committed to the moral vision of early Christianity. As you read on, what is he saying? I don't know that Constantine meant to do this, but he turned what had been a lean, hungry, grassroots movement built on sacrificial commitment and costly love to Jesus and one another, and consequently it had been growing and growing quickly, he turned it into a rich and bloated and politically powerful public institution. He corrupted and crippled the church. Certainly the church of power. At another level, at a lower level, there was the church of piety continued. But he crippled and corrupted the church because he made it a fat, bloated public service and made Christian leadership easy, prestigious, and he undermined the whole dynamic that had made Christianity grow so quickly for three centuries. As I look at our culture and think about Christendom, I can see some reasons why God may actually allow or even construct the fading away of Christendom. Because to be a truly powerful movement, Christianity needs to be lean and hungry and grassroots and built on sacrificial commitment and costly love to Jesus and to one another. Oh, folks, I'll start answering. There's some other questions being written. I'll start trying to answer some of these. We live in a society that is accepting of all people and all religions. How do we as Christians, for those of us who are Christian, how do we deal with that while professing Christianity is the one true religion? Does that push people away? Thanks, Brennan. No, there's been a change in the meaning of the word tolerance over the last maybe 30, 40 years. The American Christian author Don Carson's written a book about that, The Intolerance of Tolerance. Tolerance used to mean, I disagree with you, but I respect the fact that we can disagree and I will fight for your freedom of speech so that we can disagree. Tolerance has now come to mean we have to say that everyone is right regardless of what they think. That change has meant now that you're not actually supposed to disagree or to say that anyone else is wrong. In the area of religion, 20 years ago, as I was trying to do work on university campuses, etc., people would say, whatever you believe is true for you, and you should be able to practice whatever you believe. Now, events like 9/11 and Islamic terrorism has kind of punctured that balloon. I don't hear people say that anymore. It's 1 Peter chapter 3:15 is the answer, and that is, we need, if you're a Christian, you need to say politely that and point to Jesus and what he taught, and to be gentle and respectful, listen to other people's views. We need to be able to argue for the truth of Christianity, and I think there's very good arguments. But all we can ever do, really, I think, is point people to the teachings of Jesus and ask them to make an informed decision. If I could have a quick plug for City Bible Forum, that is our aim, to create the spaces and opportunities so that people can make an informed decision about Jesus as a person and his teaching for themselves. Does it push people away? The message of Jesus is divisive. And if you read the Gospels, Jesus himself was divisive. People loved him or hate him. The message may push people away. The behaviour of Christians should never push people away. Sometimes Christians are arrogant and obnoxious, etc. We are sinners, and that should not be the case. Christianity may be declining in certain Western countries, Europe and the USA, etc., but what about the marked rise of Christianity in Africa and some Asian countries during the same period? Is that an example of the church of power versus the church of piety? It's certainly true. Philip Jenkins, in his book The Next Christendom, lists the huge rise of Christianity in South America, in Africa and in Asia. As well as Rodney Stark's recent book, The Triumph of Faith, is also very relevant. So huge numbers in what's generally referred to as the Global South. Christian commitment is declining in Western countries, although Rodney Stark would argue that genuine Christian commitment wasn't really there in the first place, particularly as he looks at numbers and church attendance in Europe. His chapters in that book, very interesting. So The Triumph of Faith, Rodney Stark, if you're interested. Is it an example of the church of power versus the church of piety? It does seem that the growth of Christian churches in Africa, in India and in South America has happened at a grassroots viral level rather than in state-sponsored churches. In fact, what I can see is the quickest way to kill a church's vibrancy is to make it part of the state and to pay clergy out of state funds. Wherever that's happened, that's basically death, because you turn the church into the public service. Not that there's anything wrong with public servants, but they're just the two don't necessarily mix. Where does the idea that Christianity should be privileged come from? Should Christians be seeking to maintain that privilege? I think the idea of privilege came from the fact that from Constantine, and then bishops became more and more powerful, and somehow the church and the state are mixed. So you get to the Middle Ages where the Pope is, the Church of Rome is really ruling so much with massive political power, which seems to me to be against what Jesus expected, in that his kingdom is not of this world, he told Pontius Pilate. Should we seek to maintain that privilege? I like Michael Callahan's organisation that he started, Freedom for Faith. In fact, Michael's not here this morning, but I'd give that a plug. It's brilliant. Michael's not necessarily trying to privilege Christians in the society. Michael wants people of faith to be able to, of all faiths, to be able to operate and have their faith, to be able to speak freely. And so I'm not sure that Christians should have that privilege, but we should be able to have freedom of speech and freedom of faith. There are certain... perhaps I'm being inconsistent here. I'll show my petticoat. There are certain opportunities to speak about Jesus in our society, like the opportunity to teach scripture in schools, of those things that I think are worth fighting for, worth trying to hold on to. But at the same time, I think if Christians can go into schools and teach Christianity, I think Muslims should be able to go in and teach Muslim kids as well. Okay, so I'm all for freedom of speech and freedom of opportunity. Does the enormous growth of Christianity in China, Africa, South America, and the decline in the West not demonstrate that wealth is a rocky path to spread seed on? I think that is true, and Roy Williams, in his book Post God Nation, says that. I think that wealth, and it's interesting that Jesus taught more about money and the seduction of money than almost any other subject, that wealth and comfort tend to close people's eyes to thinking about God, and I think you can see that has happened in the Western world. It's ironic that Christianity has bought the creation of wealth and the possibility of capitalism that has led to so much wealth, and yet ironically that wealth leads people away from God. At the same time, Christianity has made for the possibility of science, and Christianity arose in Western Europe. And then at the same time, as science has grown, that has been used as a reason for people to walk away from God. And the other one is that Christianity made the rights of the individual possible and the value of the individual, and then individualism has also made people use that as a reason to walk away from God. I think it's the Christian faith gives so many good things, and yet human nature uses those good things as an excuse to ignore the one who's given them the good things.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.